Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a special conversation with Henry Kissinger on Otto von Bismarck.
Bismarck had an extraordinary ability to analyze the essence of a diplomatic situation.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Linguist Ben Zimmer guides us to the complications of slang.
They had come up with this funny word that combined giant and enormous into a new word, ginormous.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. At the age of 87, Henry Kissinger is not only one of the most famous ex-diplomats in the world, he's also one of the most literary. And the Book Review asked him to review a new biography of an even more celebrated diplomat, Otto von Bismarck. The book is called Bismarck, A Life by Jonathan Steinberg, and Mr. Kissinger reviewed it on our cover. Recently, I interviewed Dr. Kissinger about his review and also about world events.
Dr. Kissinger, thanks so much for giving us some time.
Glad to be here.
One of the greatest of all modern diplomats, what were his particular gifts, Bismarck's?
Bismarck had an extraordinary ability to analyze the essence of a diplomatic situation. But beyond that, he understood the revolutionary upheavals that were taking place in the Europe of the mid-19th century. And finally, he knew something that was rare in German statesmen, the limits of German possibilities. And so he conducted a diplomacy that achieved for Germany the maximum that he considered important, namely German unification. But then he preserved it by the opposite methods of moderation and balance, but it had no ideological basis, and therefore it depended on a tour de force of juggling contending forces, and that was hard to, impossible to institutionalize.
You say in your review that Bismarck is often thought of purely as a realist, but in fact he balanced realism and idealism and was very circumspect about power. Is that a formula that's still essential for diplomats and statesmen today?
The key decisions a statesman has to make are 50.5 against 49.5. They're very narrow decisions. The other ones get made at lower levels or sort of automatically. But the key decisions, the seminal decisions, are usually very close decisions. And that means you are on a road in which you are really dependent on your own inner strength. Bismarck had that quality, but he did not get seduced by success. He achieved what he had set forth in his programmatic period, and that was more than any contemporary had thought possible. But once he had achieved it, his policy was to preserve it. The difficulty he had was that he achieved it by a brilliant assessment of the balancing of power and moving and balancing all the various elements against each other. But that sort of analysis, it's a continuing exercise, is extremely difficult to sustain. And unless you have some ideological and moral convictions to back it up, which enables you to generalize it and make it generally acceptable, every single move becomes a tour de force, and that proved too much even for him.
Let me quote you a remark of Bismarck's that you yourself quote in your essay. You write, "Woe to the statesman whose arguments for entering a war are not as convincing at its end as they were at the beginning." How does that apply to recent American foreign policy?
Well, I think the problem, if you study the wars that America has fought since the end of World War II, we always ended them with a broad national consensus and with great conviction. But we were never able to describe an outcome that could be reduced to concrete terms. And so once the costs of the war began to multiply, and above all, once it became clear that it would have no overwhelming outcome, so that it was an adjustment between various contingencies, then public divisions occurred. And we developed this typically American view that to have an exit strategy. But one doesn't fight for an exit strategy, one fights for an outcome. And that we had great difficulty ever adequately defining in Korea, in Vietnam, in Iraq, and it yet remains to be seen how we do it in Libya.
President Obama spoke last night about Libya, and this question of outcome versus exit strategy seemed to some to be an unresolved one. Is that how you see it as well?
Well, the essence, that what Bismarck was trying to say, the essence of any military, I suppose any diplomatic thing, is that your actions produce consequences that themselves affect the ultimate outcome. So if the issue is defined, did we preserve the Libyan population from genocide by Gaddafi, there can be a debate whether there was a genuine threat for genocide or whether psychological warfare by Gaddafi was taken too literally. But that's an irrelevant debate to the current issue. The key issue now is what happens in a country that was never in its history a nation, that was a colony, then a weak kind of monarchy without really central control, then a feudal possession of a autocrat who governed by balancing various tribes against each other. What happens now if we try to establish a modern, or if somebody tries to establish a modern legitimate government? The first question is, who's going to establish it? President said the Libyan people should. But who are the Libyan people? They'll probably be tribal conflicts. I find it striking and understandable, it's not a criticism, that we don't really know who these rebel leaders are in Benghazi and what their capacity is to make their red run in the Tripoli area. And one of the aspects of Gaddafi was that he was so bizarre that he was separate even from the main currents in the Islamic world and had huge resources, which he put at the service of himself. What happens when these resources become used for general objectives and how you define those? That will be a big challenge, and we have to be able to answer, how is that authority going to be determined? Of course, you can see it's not our job. And that's true. It's not our job to establish the authority, but it will get established in some fashion. And that establishment will have consequences. And that's, I suspect, how the Libyan action will ultimately be judged.
And what about President Bush's intervention in Iraq? Was this a case, too, where the arguments at the outset didn't seem as strong as they were, or seemed different from what they were at the end?
One could argue in the Iraq case, I believe the original impetus for considering invading Iraq was the belief that some demonstration of American power was needed in the aftermath of 9/11, and that our action in Afghanistan was not enough to supply that. And that drew attention to Iraq, where the settlement had been somewhat controversial of the first Iraq war, and which had violated that settlement according to, I forget, quite a few UN votes which were generally agreed to, and where there was a congressional resolution signed by Clinton declaring regime change an American national objective without creating obligation necessarily to do it. It was a sense of the Senate resolution. So all this came together in creating the original impetus. And as the planning proceeded, it seems to me there was the idea that this could have been fulfilled theoretically by overthrowing Saddam, putting in power whatever group emerged or that one chose, and then essentially withdrawing from the political construction. Then President Bush, whom I have personally considerable respect, decided that he wanted to turn Iraq into a showcase of the possibility of a democratic evolution inside the Arab world. That was a huge objective. And that argument was difficult to sustain in a multi-ethnic society where resistance against occupation merged with resistance to between the various ethnic groups to each other. But yes, I would say the Iraq War fits that category.
Dr. Kissinger, you also wrote an essay for us about Dean Acheson, who you said is the greatest of all modern American secretaries of state. And let me quote you something you said there. Secretaries of state who seek to base their influence on the prerogatives of the office invariably become marginalized. Presidents cannot be constrained by administrative flowcharts. For a secretary of state to be effective, he or she has to get into the president's head, so to speak. Looking back at some recent secretaries of state, Secretary Powell, Secretary Clinton, how are they faring? How are they doing in this by this measurement?
Well, Secretary Powell, who's a friend of mine, thought of his position hierarchically in terms of a military commander. And I have the impression that his attitude was that the commander-in-chief can tell him what hill to take, but he couldn't tell him how to take the hill, that was his prerogative. But that is not how it works in the diplomatic field in the American system. There needs to be a coming together of the thinking of the Secretary of State and of the President before the issue of who gives the order ever arises. So if one thinks of the State Department as the final judge of making the ultimate recommendations, which are then left to the President to approve or to disapprove, then one will run afoul of the many advisors who keep talking to the President about the intangibles of various other aspects of considering it, and who will not be impressed by the fact that one department has the monopoly of foreign representation. So I think that was one problem from an outsider's view. Secretary Clinton was a political opponent of the current president in the primaries. I think both sides have made a heroic effort to work together, but the administrative methods of the current White House seem to me to lead to a segmentation of all policy into a series of concrete issues that find their way up to various stovepipes to the White House, each of which is treated separately on its so-called merits, in each of which all departments are represented, but the overall guidance of the secretary of any of the departments is, in a way, weakened. I have huge respect for Hillary. I think she has tremendous analytic ability and does an excellent job in public diplomacy. But I think whatever problems I see of that nature are inherent in the system and not so much in the personal relation of the two leaders.
One last question. You once said Richard Nixon is a strategic pessimist. How would you describe yourself?
I try to understand without pessimism or optimism. I try to define long-term objectives that will enable one to rise above the 50.5 versus 49.5 problem. But when one has practiced diplomacy for much of one's adult life, one always runs the danger that one doesn't set the goals high enough. Others will have to judge that, but that's how I would define myself, without a specific label. But there's certainly lots of people who are defining me, so there's no shortage of adjectives and even of epithets.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kissinger.
To see a video of my conversation with Dr. Kissinger, go to nytimes.com. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, our former colleague Joseph Lelyveld, who has written this important book on Gandhi, suddenly finds himself a source of controversy. How come?
Well, the book went on sale here in the United States this Tuesday, and it has not yet gone on sale in India, but it has caused quite a controversy there. One state has already banned the book, and many more bans are proposed. And this is all because of a suggestion in the book, a misperception, as Joe Lelyveld says, that Gandhi had a homosexual relationship.
Misperception, why? Lead us through this. What exactly does the book say? Is this news? Just set this up for us.
Lelyveld refers in the book to letters, which were between Gandhi and a German-Jewish architect named Hermann Kallenbach. Gandhi lived with Kallenbach for several years in Johannesburg, and they exchanged letters, which were reprinted in the book. Now, as Lelyveld says, these letters were no great discovery of his. They have been in the National Archives of India since at least 1994. But no other book has introduced them to such a wide audience and explored them at such great length. So Lelyveld says he knew that this was going to be a very sensitive topic.
And where does the misperception arise?
So in the letters, Gandhi expresses great fondness and yearning for Mr. Kallenbach. He tells Mr. Kallenbach that his was the only portrait on Gandhi's mantle, and he says that cotton wool and Vaseline were, quote, a constant reminder of Kallenbach. Interpret that as you will, but many people have decided that this means that Kallenbach and Gandhi were having a sexual relationship, and this has made a lot of people very angry in India.
Does Joe Lelyveld, in his book or in interviews you've done with him, public comments, offered his own interpretation of these letters?
Well, in the book, he does not conclude that Gandhi's relationship with Kallenbach was sexual or romantic, but he does say that it was intimate, ambiguous, and certainly the most intimate relationship of Gandhi's lifetime. Mr. Lelyveld also says that in the book that selectively chosen details of the relationship and quotes from the letters could easily be arranged to suggest a conclusion. Lelyveld also says that he did not intend this to be the central preoccupation of the book. He says that, you know, his book is about Gandhi's struggle for social justice. It is not about his intimate relationships, but that he was a complicated man and that the two are linked.
Now, Julie, this has created an uproar. You said it's already been banned in one Indian state, with more to come. What exactly is everyone, or some people, authorities, so upset about? Is there a political dimension to this, or an ideological one at all? Or is this purely because questions have been raised about this great figure and his complex life?
Well, India has a very limited idea of what free speech is. There is a great deal of censorship in the country of what can be printed in books, what movies can be shown, and Gandhi is perhaps one of the most sensitive subjects of all. And under Indian law, any citizen can petition to have a work banned, and that right is frequently exercised by politicians and activists.
Now, Julie, you very closely cover the publishing beat here in the United States. What does Lullyveld's publisher have any response to this? Or was this a book they really did intend to have translated and published to that enormous audience in India?
India has an enormous, thriving publishing scene. You know, many U.S. publishers count on selling many, many books there, and certainly a book about Gandhi would be of great interest there. Knopf is the publisher of the book in the United States, but HarperCollins owns the rights to publish the book in India. Now, HarperCollins seems to be getting a little bit weak in the knees about publishing the book in India. They have said that they are committed to their author, they're committed to the book, they will publish it, but they have not said what date they will publish it or even what month they will publish it. So we'll have to wait and see if that happens. An editor at HarperCollins did request that Mr. Lullyveld remove at least one passage from the book, and he declined to do so. So the book was originally intended to be published there sometime this summer, so we're not sure what will happen.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on that one. Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Slang, we all use it, sometimes when we don't even know we're using it, but most of us don't know much about it. There is an enormous new 3-volume book, Green's Dictionary of Slang, published by Oxford University Press, and it's the subject of our back page essay this week by the linguist Ben Zimmer, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you.
3 volumes?
3 huge volumes. We're talking more than 6,000 pages, a total of about 110,000 definitions with more than 400,000 citations, because it's a historical dictionary. It's got lots and lots of citations for every word and phrase in the dictionary. So it's a truly monumental work.
Where does he find all these words and the different uses of them?
Well, there's lots of research that has to go into a dictionary like this, obviously, and we're limited in many ways when we're talking about slang to finding it in print sources, which can be difficult because slang very often is a kind of oral language that might not necessarily work its way into print sources very quickly. This was even truer in, you know, earlier decades and earlier centuries, before there was a kind of a loosening up of the language, starting in, say, the 1950s and 60s, when slang would become more appropriate to, you know, find its way, say, into a newspaper article or, you know, some other written source. So sometimes, you know, just beyond looking at those conventional sources, you have to dig a little deeper and look at correspondence, for instance, between people where they might be not trying to use the most formal or edited prose. And so slang could slip into correspondence, and you could look at correspondence back in the Civil War, for instance, to look at the types of colloquial expressions that soldiers were using back then. What's interesting is, like, much of this historical material is now available and searchable in new ways. There are huge databases of various types of texts that makes the searching for these terms and the historical evidence for them much easier than it used to be, where you'd have to spend hours, days, years in the library to turn up something which now can be found pretty quickly.
Since the subject is slang, I assume it's up to date or tries to be.
It tries to be. Part of the problem with slang is it's very slippery, and it's very hard to stay up to date. If you put out an enormous dictionary like this, you can be guaranteed that a lot of the most recent slang terms will not be included. But the author of this, Jonathan Green, was trying to cast, obviously, a very wide historical net and going, you know, back centuries in the history of English to show how slang has evolved. Some of it can be very evanescent, but some of it actually sticks around for quite a while, despite it seeming to be this type of language that we only use in oral communication, perhaps. But a lot of it actually sticks around quite a lot and is recorded in print over the centuries.
Yeah, tell us about some words that might sound kind of newish, if not really new to us, that have been around for a really long time.
Well, you know, some terms can maintain their slanginess over centuries. So, you know, if you think about booze, meaning liquor, that still seems pretty slangy to us. But it was slangy in the 16th century, and somehow it's maintained its appeal over the years. You know, sometimes words can be actually more standard or accepted and then kind of be cast off into slang usage. So one example I talk about in the essay is crib, which Shakespeare used to talk about, a small house, perhaps. Over time, crib to mean house found a new life in mostly African-American slang. And then we have things like MTV cribs, which are certainly not modest houses at all. But we could see how, even Shakespearean language can sometimes take on slangy inflections.
Okay, so we have Green, who's doing that always interesting thing, which is to research and write in a very serious way about a topic some of us might not at first think is so serious. He's written a kind of an OED of slang. Does he have any, like, big argument or theory about what slang really is, why it's important, how it got developed, why we use it?
Well, Green does present some of those arguments in the introduction to this dictionary, and he makes a case for slang as what he calls a counter language. He says that slang fulfills the desire of human beings when faced by a standard version of whatever that might be to come up with something different, perhaps parallel, perhaps oppositional. Slang is notoriously difficult to define, but the way that Green presents it, again, as this counter language means that it's always kind of in opposition of some sort to standard or dominant forms of the language. And that often means that the language has to remain secret, because if it becomes too widely known, then it loses that special cachet as counter language. But obviously, these days, it's difficult for any kind of slangy terms to stay in a particular subculture, because people are online now, they're sharing this kind of non-standard English all the time. It can very often just blow up into something that's not so special. And so there's always this need to reinvent slang as well, to come up with new terms, because yesterday's slang or previous generations' use of slang just might not cut it.
Ben, let me ask you about some words that kind of enter the language or don't, that are floating around, and ask you whether they qualify as slang. You mentioned some in your essay. We have humongous, we have ginormous, hugeacious.
A word like ginormous, you know, there was some controversy a few years back when Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary announced what new words were going into its latest revision, and it included ginormous, obviously marked as slang. You know, a word like that has actually been around for a while. There are citations for that word going back to the 1940s. It apparently became popular originally in the Royal Air Force in the UK. And Eric Partridge, who was a great chronicler of slang in the UK, Jonathan Green's predecessor in many ways, had noted this as part of sort of military slang. They had come up with this funny word that combined giant and enormous into a new word, ginormous. It was interesting to see how people got kind of up in arms about ginormous entering Merriam-Webster's. Another example would be when the Oxford English Dictionary puts in slang terms, which it does a lot lately because it's obviously a descriptive effort. Even if slang terms are not considered standard or proper for various forms of formal language use, that doesn't mean they should be shut out from a dictionary like the Oxford English Dictionary. So a term like bootylicious, for instance, when that entered...
That's slang?
obviously, that term has become very popular thanks to musical uses like from Beyoncé that found a place in the Oxford English Dictionary, and there was much hand-wringing when that was announced. But this is the way that dictionaries are made these days. Slang, marked as slang, is very much a part of modern-day lexicography. What Jonathan Green has done is to compile all of this and create, as you say, an OED of slang, so showing the whole history of these terms in a very ambitious scale.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thank you.
That's Ben Zimmer, who wrote this week's back page essay on Slanguage. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week, or maybe new not on the list this week?
Yes, the most interesting thing about this week's fiction list, for me at least, is what's not there. Catherine Stockett's blockbuster hit, The Help. After 103 weeks, it has disappeared, but it's not gone for long. The book is out in paperback April 5th. So if there's anybody in America or the world who hasn't read this book yet, it may pop up on the paperback list next week.
What else have we got?
Well, we have a new number one. Harlan Coben knocks out James Patterson. Patterson was at number one with Toys last week. This week, Harlan Coben is at number one with his latest. It's called Livewire. And here, his hero, Myron Bolitar, goes in search of a missing rock star.
Speaking of missing rock stars, what happened to Sammy Hager, who was number one last week in nonfiction?
Sammy has got a lot of hair, but apparently he does not have legs. He drops to number three in his second week, and he is right behind the real rock stars, Laura Hillenbrand. She's back on top with Unbroken. This is its 19th week on the list. And David Brooks of the New York Times is back at number two with The Social Animal.
Jenny, I thought David Brooks had stumbled a little bit.
Well, he went down to number four last week. He entered at number one 2 weeks ago, dropped to number four, but now he's back at number two, so things are back on track for him.
And Jenny, are you still tracking the ebooks list, and are we still seeing differences between the ebook list and the print list, or surprises when everything is mashed together?
To a certain extent, yes. The number one title on the nonfiction ebooks list and the number one title on the combined books list, that combines all sales from ebooks, hardcover sales, paperback sales, everything together. It's not Laura Hillenbrand. It is Todd Burpo and Lynn Vincent with their book, Heaven is for Real. Remember, this is the story of a young, I think, three-year-old preacher's son who dies or has a near-death experience, goes briefly to heaven, meets Jesus, has a great time, but decides he wants to come back and live the rest of his life and maybe sell a few books.
Speaking of selling a few books, wasn't Lynn Vincent Sarah Palin's co-author?
Yes, she was.
I wonder if I could get her to help me with my new book.
Good luck.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.